The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Mark Weber Report. Mr. Weber is a historian, author, current affairs analyst, and director of the Institute for Historical Review. Visit the IHR at ihr.org. And now, Mark Weber.
Hello and welcome. This is Mark Weber. Each week at this time, I take a look at current affairs and historical topics of interest with perspective and background on relevant issues. As you may already know, I'm director of the Institute for Historical Review. I urge you to check out the IHR website at ihr.org. I'm going to begin today by talking about an issue that's been in the news a lot during the past week and has been front and center in international news coverage, the conflict in Libya and the U.S. involvement in that conflict, as it's been debated here and discussed here in our country. When Barack Obama was running for president in the campaign in 2007 and 2008, he made clear over and over that he was promising the American public a drastic change in U.S. foreign policy. He was going to be a very different kind of president in international affairs than his predecessor, George W. Bush. For example, in a debate on August 7, 2007, he said that the fact of the matter is that when we don't talk to the American people, we're debating the most important foreign policy issue that we face, and the American people have a right to know. It's not just Washington insiders that are part of the debate that has to take place with respect to how we're going to shift our foreign policy, he said. Well, the remarkable thing about the Obama administration in international affairs is not how much of a break he has brought about in contrast to the Bush administration, but how much continuity there is by Barack Obama's policy compared to that of his predecessor, George W. Bush. And now, most recently, he's brought the United States into a conflict in Libya with American military planes involvement, American military involvement in a conflict, in a war, without any national debate, without any real authorization, a war and an involvement that is illegal, with no legal authority, no debate, no discussion, and on the pretext that he's doing this to for humanitarian reasons and trying to help people. It's remarkable how little criticism there has been of the Obama administration's involvement in militarily in Libya, and to compare what the reaction by leading Democrats would be if a Republican president were to carry out a similar intervention. Now, first and foremost, this war is not in the U.S. national interest. There is no U.S. national interest in being involved in this conflict. And remarkably, just the other day, the Defense Secretary Gates even made this point explicitly. Robert Gates said that Libya was not a vital national interest of the United States. And this should be clear. This is an internal affair. We're not even sure if this is a civil war, if it's a kind of a coup with some popular support. The leadership of the opposition in this conflict is unclear. In any case, it's an internal matter. Imagine how Americans would have reacted if during the American Civil War the British or the French had sent troops into the United States and landed troops saying that it was doing so to protect American civilian lives. Well, however much Americans and the Lincoln government might have been trying to put down the rebellion in the South, they would have been outraged, of course, if any foreign country had been involved in that conflict. But the United States is now involved in a purely internal affair in Libya, in which there is no real U.S. national interest. Second, there is no constitutional authority for such a war or for such an intervention. The Constitution says that only Congress has the power to declare war. Well, the United States is now effectively at war against the government of Muammar Gaddafi, a government the United States recognizes or has recognized as the legitimate government of that country. We have diplomatic relations with Gaddafi, and in fact, relations with Gaddafi have been more friendly in recent years than they were some time ago. The U.S. involvement in Libya is also hypocritical. The United States claims that it's doing so for humanitarian reasons. It has to protect people. But time and again, the United States has stayed out of conflicts that represent, that mean far greater loss of life than they have in the case of Libya. Most notably, the biggest double standard, of course, in U.S. Middle East policy is its attitude and its relationship with Arab countries on the one hand and its relationship with Israel on the other. The centerpiece, the driving force behind U.S. Policy in the Middle East is first and foremost what's good for Israel. And what Israel deems as in its interest is the primary consideration. As a result, when Israel has invaded Lebanon on several occasions, the United States did not punish or do anything to stop Israeli involvement in those conflicts. In fact, Israel has carried out military strikes in an invasion of Lebanon, even in violation of American law, by using weaponry supplied by the United States that is, by law, meant to be used only for defensive purposes. More recently, the United States did not intervene in the Israeli incursion, invasion of the Gaza Strip area with considerable, great loss of life, much killing of civilians, because the Israel and the Israel lobby in the United States justified and supported the invasion, and Israel's supporters and friends in the U.S. Congress and in the media sanctioned this action, again, in hypocritical contradiction in contrast to the U.S. invasion now in Libya. One thing that to be learned from history is over and over again is that military conflicts very often turn out differently, very differently than anybody imagines when the conflict begins. When the United States got involved in the Vietnam War, the ultimate result was very different than the United States expected. When the United States was involved in the Spanish-American War in 1898, or in the First World War of 1914-1918, the United States was involved in 1917-1918, the result was very different than the what the American president and American leaders proclaimed at the time. And the Iraq War, more recently, the United States invaded in 2003, turned out very differently than George W. Bush and his others in the administration and those who supported the war claimed at the time. There's a great danger as well, even a greater danger in this case, that the Libya conflict could turn out very, very differently than Barack Obama and other people who are supporting the intervention claim or suppose. One of the reasons for that is that there's no clear idea of who the United States is supporting as an alternative to the Gaddafi government. The United States is called for effectively the overthrow of the Gaddafi government, but it's very unclear the nature and the policies of the of those who are most likely to take over if Gaddafi is overthrown and if he's out of office. There isn't any clear leadership to the opposition. There's no clear military cohesiveness to the opposition. And very often in international affairs, countries should ask themselves very carefully before they begin what they wish for, because and examine what they wish for, because oftentimes it turns out very differently than they expect. A good example of that is in the Afghanistan conflict when the Soviet Union invaded. The United States supported the so-called Mujahideen, the rebels against the Soviet military occupation, Soviet military involvement in Afghanistan, and among those people in opposition was Osama bin Laden. The opposition to the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan were not necessarily at all friendly to the United States or the kind of people the United States had any real interest in supporting. And this may turn out, it could very well turn out to be the case in Libya. We just don't have any clear idea. Now, there's a more dangerous principle involved here, and that is that justifying U.S. military intervention because it's for humanitarian reasons is a very dangerous principle. It's a dangerous one because there will always be around the world humanitarian crises or conflicts involving a loss of life around the world in which there's no real U.S. Interest involved. But if the United States were to involve itself in every military conflict or every conflict around the world in which human life is, human beings are being killed, then the United States should just officially set itself up as a nanny policeman for the world, because there'll be no end to U.S. involvement in wars and conflicts all over the world. The first and foremost principle of U.S. foreign policy, and especially military intervention around the world, should be, is it in the interest of the United States? Is it in the authentic interest of the American people and and the United States? There is no, in this case, any U.S. real interest involved in this conflict. And the Obama administration's involvement is wrong just for that, on that basis alone. It's also a dangerous principle even in domestic affairs. If humanitarian principles are more important than the collective interests of the country and of the American people, then it's very difficult to enforce, for example, immigration laws. If the United States is, and any country, is carrying out its immigration law on the basis of humanitarian principles rather than the interests of the country, then it has no firm basis upon which to uphold its immigration laws if it means hardship for people who have come into the country illegally. Talking about how wars turn out often very differently than people imagine or expect, it's worth looking back over history and comparing how difficult it is to predict how things will turn out in the future. If we take almost any 20-year period and look at how the changes took place over that 20-year period, it's notable that very few people foresaw at the end of that period how things would turn out. In 1980, for example, very few people foresaw the momentous changes that took place in the 20-year period from 1980 to the year 2000. In 1980, very few people foresaw the end of the Soviet Union, the fall of the Berlin Wall, the withdrawal of Soviet forces from Eastern Europe, from Hungary, Poland, Czechoslovakia, and so forth. The end of Czechoslovakia as a country and its breakup into the Czech Republic and Slovakia. All of those changes, as momentous as they were foreseen by very, very few people. if we go back further in time, very few people, say, in 1900, foresaw the world of 1920. Almost nobody foresaw the cataclysmic horrors of the First World War of 1914 to 1918. And that in 1900, looking ahead 20 years, that there would be such devastation and the end of what seemed to be the very stable and long-lasting, durable monarchies in Russia. The Romanov Empire had been in place for centuries. The Habsburg monarchy had been in place for centuries in Austria-Hungary. And the Hohenzollern dynasty had been in place in Germany. By 1920, all those dynasties and those empires had been swept away. And in place in Russia, of course, the Tsarist government that had been in place in 1900 was replaced by the Bolshevik regime of Lenin. In Austria-Hungary, the empire was replaced by a whole series of smaller, squabbling states that emerged in the aftermath of the breakup of the Habsburg monarchy. And of course, in Germany, there was chaos in that country as well in the aftermath of the First World War. But almost nobody in 1900 anticipated that. In fact, in 1900, overwhelmingly, people expected things to just carry on in a trajectory that was already in place, and that the Western world would continue to be a prosperous and society that with even more impressive technological advances than had been in place before that. But similarly, in 1920, very few people foresaw the world of 1940, and so forth. Now, we're living in the year 1911. If we dare look ahead to the year 2031, it's very difficult to predict what the world will look like. But one thing I think can be said with confidence, it'll be very different than the world we live in today. It's very difficult to understand and predict precisely what will happen during any period, but it's important to understand the underlying forces, the underlying currents in history, and that's the best guide to understanding what's likely to happen in the future. Here in our country, in the United States, there are such tremendous changes that have been taking place over the last 40, 50 years, above all demographically, that I think it's safe to say that there will be very, very sweeping, profound changes in the next 15, 20 years here in the United States. Changes that the leaders of both major political parties and the intellectual leaders of the United States right now seem unable to anticipate or to much less, not only not to foresee, but unable to take any, much less to take any actions to deal with them. The leaders of both major parties are seemingly unable even to propose policies to deal with the limited economic problems, financial problems that exist already in the United States, much less with any clear vision about how the United States will be in the years ahead. So while it's difficult to predict precisely what will happen year by year, month by month, or even decade by decade, it is possible to foresee larger trends in history by looking at the examples of the past. A very good book in this regard that's very enlightening, full of a lot of very interesting data, information, and insights, is The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers by Paul Kennedy. He makes the point in this book that it's precisely very powerful, rich states that are often least able to understand their real role in the world and their own weaknesses, because their power and wealth and blind them to these weaknesses. The British Empire, for example, never seemed more powerful, more and bigger than it did in 1939. But looking back, we understand that the weaknesses that led to the total collapse and disappearance of the British Empire 10, 15 years later, were already in place. Those factors were already in play in 1939, 38, when the British Empire seemed so superficially, on surface, very, very powerful. In the book, Paul Kennedy gives many other examples of how empires engage what he calls a kind of overreach, an overstretch, in which they carry out international policy far beyond their ability because they are blinded by their own seeming greatness and military power in the world. And he makes the point, of course, in the book, that the United States today faces a similar problem, a similar crisis, because there's an inability by many people in America, by the political leaders, to understand our own limitations that financially and internally we have in this country, the weaknesses here that we should be conscious of and should take into account. But instead, there's a tendency in the United States, as there has been in other strong and important powers in the past, to discard that and to carry on as if they were still as powerful as ever. Now, here in the United States, the most obvious reality of the last several years is the United States is effectively broke. We don't have the money to carry on with the same living standard, the same place in the world that we did 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 years ago, because the America's place in the world relatively has changed drastically. This isn't And our leaders are oftentimes representing public opinion in this regard, still believe or want to believe that America is just as great as it has been, its power is still as great if we just pretend that it is. Now, the lack of money, the fact that the United States is now effectively broke, ought to be first and foremost a good reason why the United States shouldn't be involved in this conflict in Libya. We don't have the money to afford it. We're already involved, of course, in this seemingly endless conflict in Afghanistan, and the American forces are still involved in Iraq in a situation that's not at all clear, and that the situation there, of course, is still very fluid, very unresolved there. But at a time when the United States is unable to really bring an end and close the book on those two involvements, to be involved now in Libya is just stupid. Now, I mentioned earlier, of course, the hypocrisy of U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East. And at a time when throughout the world, and especially in Arab and Muslim countries, there's a very acute awareness of the double standard of U.S. foreign policy, particularly in the Middle East, that supports repressive and unrepresentative regimes in Arab countries while proclaiming its support for democracy, on the other hand, and the support for Israel when it carries out policies that are contrary to international law and to even American law and American interests, makes it all the more unadvisable, all the more stupid to be involved in a conflict in Libya that is an internal affair, especially now that U.S. Actions in Libya are coming up against increasing criticism from Arab countries, from African countries, and perhaps more importantly, from Russia and Chinese leaders. This is all the more reason to carry out a foreign policy that is prudent. But this is very difficult because U.S. foreign policy is increasingly motivated not by authentic national interests, but by ideological pretext of concern for humanity, which of course is a recipe for open-ended, endless involvement in wars around the world and conflict around the world. It's not surprising then that the Obama administration has sent American forces into the Libyan conflict without any real national debate or mandate from the American public, because the American public has already been deceived and fooled time and again in the past about involvement in foreign wars. And at a time when we are simply broke and so many Americans are out of work or having such problems here internally, there's less and less willingness to support military campaigns overseas that have only the most remote relationship to real problems, real issues that we face here at home in America. We're going to take a break now for a few moments, and I hope you'll join me for the second half of this broadcast of the Mark Weber Report.
Stay tuned for more of the Mark Weber Report. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
And it's not just the coverage of the conflict, there are also mounting criticisms of the strategy itself. Some call President Obama's decision to get involved in Libya hypocrisy, asking, if Libya, why not Yemen or Bahrain? But others say, let's look a little closer to home, to countries on our own border, where there are plenty of innocent civilians being massacred. Countries like, say, Mexico. Earlier I spoke to Enrique Morones, founder of Border Angels. Here's part of our conversation.
Here, right on the border between San Diego and Tijuana, Mexico and the United States, we've had 15,000 people slaughtered, innocent people that are simply trying to cross the border for a better life. They have no legal way of coming in, and they're being slaughtered. In essence, they're being slaughtered. President Obama said the words of the world community, the words will be hollow if they don't take action, that we need to do things for humanity, human rights. How about right here? How about with two people dying every day? How about the fact that that these people are being slaughtered? They're right on our front door. President Obama needs to step up and practice what he preaches, not only in the Middle East where there's oil, but right here on our front door.
But Enrique, it's a little different here because, you know, in this situation we have evil dictator Muammar Gaddafi willing to, you know, he said he's willing to go in and slaughter his own people. I know you're not saying that Mexico's leader, Felipe Calderon, is an evil dictator. I think you're talking more about what's going on with the drug cartels. Is that a fair assessment?
That's right, and I'm not saying this is President Calderon. What I'm saying is that this administration, the United States, does not pass humane immigration reform, and as a result, two people die every day. The drugs that are crossing the border is because of the U.S. demand for drugs. You know, we have 4.5% of the world's population, yet the United States consumes half the world's illegal drugs. Got to stop that demand. Innocent people are being killed. Where's the human rights in this issue? Where is the humane immigration reform? We've got to do something about that today, not tomorrow. Because it's not an evil dictator in Mexico or the United States. These are two presidents that have met, that have talked about making a stronger Mexico, a stronger United States. You're going to do that by building bridges of communication, not allowing people to die on the border every day, like what is happening right now because of the U.S. demand for drugs and people coming across the border the only way they can. Both governments, U.S. and Mexico, need to do something about it. But we cannot be out in the Middle East saying that we're trying to promote human rights and not having it in our own front.
We'll be right back.
let's return to the Mark Weber Report, brought to you by VOR.
Welcome back. When we went on break, I was talking about how the American public is much more skeptical than it had been 10 or 15 or 20 or 30 years ago about the reasons given by American presidents for involvement in foreign wars. There's a long record of American presidents seizing upon false pretexts to justify American involvement in war. Many examples of that, and I'm going to talk about a few of them right now. Of course, in 1898, the United States declared war on Spain because an American ship, the USS Maine, in Havana Harbor, blew up. The United States government wasted no time in blaming the explosion and the sinking of the Maine and the loss of American life on the Spanish. At that time, Cuba was a colony of Spain, and the United States used the sinking of the USS Maine in Havana Harbor as a pretext to declare war on Spain. Now, this set off a national debate by many people about whether the United States should be an imperial power, but the aftermath of this and the seizing upon this pretext to involve the United States in war is a good example at the beginning of, just before the beginning of the 20th century, of a false claims made to get the United States involved in conflict. Now, out of that war, the United States seized Puerto Rico, seized the Philippines, and established a protectorate over Cuba and secured a very strong U.S. position in the Caribbean. But it was justified, of course, as most wars have been for the United States, on humanitarian grounds. More recently, in 1941, the President Roosevelt seized upon the an attack by a German submarine on the USS Greer in September 1941 as a pretext or excuse for effectively going to war against Germany and issuing an order to the American military to shoot on sight all German and Italian shipping in the Atlantic. Now, the United States at the time was supposedly a neutral country, but Franklin Roosevelt seized the German submarine attack on the USS Greer as a pretext for issuing this shoot-on-sight order. Now, what were the facts of this matter? In fact, the USS Greer had been trailing a German submarine and radioing this information to British warships, which were dropping depth charges on the German submarine. In fact, at the time, German submarines were under orders not to attack any American shipping and to avoid any incidents which might be seized upon by the American government to go to war against Germany. In the biography of Franklin Roosevelt by James McGregor Burns, who is a very sympathetic and supportive biographer of Franklin Roosevelt, he even acknowledges in this biography that, here's his words, "At last Roosevelt had his incident. It was not much of an incident, since the Greer had sought out the German submarine and had jeopardized it by broadcasting its position. Moreover, there was no indication that the Germans even knew whether the U.S. destroyer was British or American. But shots had been exchanged in anger, and Roosevelt, here was his chance to dramatize the Nazi menace that he had long been picturing." He declared in an address to the country, and this is the words of Franklin Roosevelt, "Our destroyer at the time was in waters which the government of the United States had declared to be waters of self-defense surrounding the outposts of American protection in the Atlantic." He went on to say, "This was piracy legally and morally. In the face of all this, we Americans are keeping our feet on the ground. He declared that Hitler's advance guards, not only his avowed agents, but also his dupes among us, have sought to make ready for him footholds and strongholds in the New World to be used as soon as he has gained control of the oceans. Roosevelt went on to say, "We have sought no shooting war with Hitler. We do not seek it now, but when you see a rattlesnake poised to strike, you do not wait until he has struck before you crush him." Then he went on to issue his so-called shoot-on-sight order, in effect, as Burns points out, declaring naval war on Germany in response to what he said was a war of aggression carried out by Germany. In fact, it was completely untrue. As I mentioned, the German submarines and German shipping were on orders to avoid any incident, and the German submarine didn't even realize that the American destroyer that was circling and going against it was even an American destroyer. But nevertheless, as I said, President Roosevelt seized upon this to issue this shoot-on-sight order. And if there was any doubt remaining, a few days later, the U.S. Secretary of the Navy, Secretary Cox, declared publicly that the Navy is ordered to capture or destroy by every means at its disposal access-controlled submarines or surface raiders in these waters. Of course, all this was completely contrary to international law. Now, a similar thing happened in 1964 under the administration of President Lyndon Johnson. He seized upon what seemed to be an attack against American shipping in the Gulf of Tonkin by ships of North Vietnam as a pretext to demand from Congress a resolution, the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, authorizing Lyndon Johnson to carry out whatever military effort he deemed necessary in carrying out war against North Vietnam. The Johnson administration misrepresented completely a very minor incident that had happened in the Gulf of Tonkin, as historians now acknowledge, and had completely, in order to get this Gulf of Tonkin resolution through Congress. But at that time, the American public had no independent way to determine what really happened and accepted the president's representation of and portrayal of the incident, and so that in the Congress, the Gulf of Tonkin resolution received in the House of Representatives unanimous support, authorizing unlimited presidential military action against North Vietnam, and in the Senate of the United States received support from all but two members of the United States Senate. The two senators that voted against the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, Wayne Morse of Oregon and Ernst Gruning of Alaska, did so not because they thought the president had been deceiving them about the facts of the attack on the on U.S. ships in the Gulf of Tonkin, but because they regarded that this Gulf of Tonkin resolution was unconstitutional. It was not a declaration of war. It was an unlimited blank check authorization for the president to carry out military action. In comparison, Barack Obama's authorization of U.S. military strikes against Libya is in a sense even worse, because he didn't even ask for authorization from the U.S. Congress. There was no debate even about that, and he carried it out as commander-in-chief. Now, Lyndon Johnson got this, as it were, fig leaf, blank check authorization from Congress on the basis of deceit, but at least there was some discussion of it, and two members of Congress, two out of all the members of the House of Representatives in the U.S. Senate, voted against it on the basis that it was unconstitutional and there was no presidential authority for carrying this out. The Johnson administration and the Vietnam War should be a very sobering chapter in American history for all American military involvement, especially because the end result was so different than any of the American leaders predicted at the time. There was an arrogance of power, an assumption that if the United States just applied enough military power, it would, quote, win the war in Vietnam. But in spite of the deaths of tens of thousands of young Americans and a huge involvement of American ground troops and of huge military power, including the bombing of Vietnam, more bombs by far were dropped on Vietnam during the Vietnam War than were dropped on both Germany and Japan and other countries in Europe during the entirety of World War II. In spite of all of that, the United States essentially lost the war because the leadership of Vietnam and millions of Vietnamese were willing to die for what they regarded as a national struggle of liberation and of freedom for their people against the foreign intervention of the United States, just as they had millions of Vietnamese that opposed the French military campaign against Vietnam earlier on. Now, the Johnson administration is a remarkable one because by most standards, Lyndon Johnson was a liar of the first order, a man of deceit, and who had even gotten into political life or had secured his place in political life through fraud. Now, Lyndon Johnson was first elected to the U.S. Senate in 1948. He had tried to be elected to the U.S. Senate in 1941 and failed. But he ran again in 1948, and he finally won against a very popular former governor, Coke Stevenson. He won the title of Landslide Lyndon in this campaign, a title that was really sarcastic, because Lyndon Johnson won the senatorial campaign in one of the closest elections in American history. He won the campaign by the primary campaign in 1948 by just 89 votes. The historians now generally acknowledge that he won that campaign through fraud. He won the election by just 89 votes, with nearly a million votes cast in all. And afterwards, it was found in a recount that 202 votes that had previously been miscounted, suddenly appeared in the election, all written in identical handwriting with the same ink and in alphabetical order, even though it was obviously a fraud because voters were supposed to sign their names and register, shown they had voted, and it obviously they couldn't have all have been doing it in the same handwriting in an alphabetical order. But that's how Lyndon Johnson was elected to the U.S. Senate in 1948 and won the title, the sarcastic title, of Landslide Lyndon. Now, Lyndon Johnson's personality was an odd one. He was a man who was very insecure personally, and because he was had come from very uneducated rural background, always felt uncomfortable in the presence of others who were better educated, more sophisticated than he was. And he particularly felt uncomfortable and resentful of the Kennedy family. He was the vice president of John F. Kennedy and became president when John Kennedy was assassinated in November 1963. but he particularly felt awkward and embarrassed because the Kennedy family and Kennedy brothers had gone to Harvard, had been well-educated, came from rich, sophisticated background. Kennedy father had been ambassador to England and head of the Securities and Exchange Commission, whereas Lyndon Johnson's background was far more humble. There's an incident that points up Lyndon Johnson's level of sophistication that comes from a biography by Doris Kearns Goodwin entitled Lyndon Johnson and the American Dream. She writes in there that Lyndon Johnson thought there was nothing strange about talking to someone, even reporters, while he was sitting on the toilet. If anything, Johnson thought it was odd when people stopped talking simply because he was using the toilet in the way that everybody does. He gave an example of this when he was talking to his biographer, Doris Kearns. One time a Kennedyite came to the bathroom, he says, with me, and then found it utterly impossible to look at me while I sat there on the toilet. You'd think he'd never seen those parts of the body before. For there he was, standing as far away from me as he possibly could, keeping his back toward me the whole time, trying to carry on a conversation. I could barely hear a word he said. I kept straining my ears, and then finally I asked him to come a little closer to me. Then began the most ludicrous scene I have ever witnessed. Instead of simply turning around and talking over to me, he kept his face around, away from me and talked backward one rickety step at a time. For a moment there, I thought he was going to run right into me. It certainly made me wonder how this man had made it so far in the world. Unquote. Well, that tells something about the kind of man that Lyndon Johnson was. Another incident, which is perhaps even more startling, is related by Stephen Gerstle, a newspaper reporter in Washington, D.C., who was with Lyndon Johnson when he was on an official visit to Thailand. He was there for a conference and was feasted very well, given plenty to drink. And during a banquet in Thailand, he had to go to the bathroom repeatedly because he was drinking a lot and presumably was at least somewhat drunk. Once when he emerged from the restroom on one of these visits, he met a group of reporters. And according to this journalist, Johnson opened his fly, pulled out his member, and commented, "Don't see him this big out here, do they?" Well, that tells something about the kind of man Lyndon Johnson was, a person who had deceived the public to get a blank check of support for the involvement in the Vietnam War, who had cheated in an election campaign to become a United States senator from Texas, and who was a man of incredible lack of sophistication and decorum that carried out behavior that most Americans would regard as reprehensible and as despicable, really. But that's how in our system, and this is a remarkable thing of the democratic system, that time and time again it produces leaders that are as corrupt or as deceitful, as mendacious as Lyndon Johnson and as other presidents have been, including Franklin Roosevelt and including George W. Bush, in the deceit that he carried out to justify the U.S. war and attack and occupation of Iraq in 2003. American leaders put a lot of stress on the greatness of American democracy, and are quick to criticize other countries for not living up to what we regard as the way governments and society and political life ought to be organized. But for foreigners, our system often seems in great need of improvement. Although there's a lot of criticism of the way things run in other countries, it's worth remembering that when George W. Bush, for example, was elected president in the year 2000, he became president in an election campaign in which he received fewer votes than his opponent, Al Gore. And that's because the peculiarities of the American political system allow a person to become president when he wins a majority of electoral college votes, even if he gets a minority of actual votes of the voters. But that's the way it works in the United States. But it should make people a little humble, though, in this country, when they're quick to criticize other countries for not having a political system that we regard as democratic as our own. Around the world, the important thing, both in our country and other countries, isn't the form of political system, it's the results. And it's hard to think that the American political system today is a healthier or a better one than that of other countries, which have a different political system. But in fact, as time goes on and the American system becomes more and more inclusive and more democratic, it's very doubtful that it actually is producing any better form of government or any better administration than we've had in the past. And it's an odd thing that even is the lack of accountability in our system, that even if a president carries out policies which are deceitful, which people acknowledge afterwards were mendacious and lying, we give a pass to it very often. It's remarkable how little call there has been for any punishment of George W. Bush, for example, for lying to the American people to justify the invasion and occupation and bombing of Iraq. Or, by the same token, that Lyndon Johnson is still regarded as, well, he's another American president and held in regard, in high regard by especially Democrats, but by Americans in general, because he was president of the United States, even if his policies turned out to be as disastrous as they were, as harmful as they were, and even though he had been elected to high position to the U.S. Senate by fraud and deceit and had lied to the American public. And similarly, we are witnessing once again that the Barack Obama administration is carrying out policies that, if carried out by Republicans, would be condemned by Democrats. But again, in this case as well, we give a pass to them because partisan loyalties are more important than the loyalty to principle and the loyalty to what's good for the United States of America, for the American people, and for humanity in the larger sense. Well, this concludes this week's broadcast of the Mark Weber Report. I hope you'll join me next time for the next installment. In the meantime, I urge you to check out the website of the Institute for Historical Review, which is online at ihr.org, and I look forward to your joining me next week.
Thanks for listening. The Mark Weber Show returns Wednesday, 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. Time, only on VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.